Professor Thomas got his PhD at Harvard University, got an MA at the University of Minnesota, and a BA from DePaul University in Chicago. And somewhere in the middle of all that, he spent two years at the University of Montpellier in southern France, where he absorbed the local wine and worked as a lecteur en anglais in the English department there. So Timothy has a long-standing interest in French culture and history, and in particular has been specializing in food culture, food history, food marketing, and in the practice and theorization of cuisine, both in medieval and Renaissance eras and also in the present day, having written or edited or translated four different books and a wide-ranging set of articles that talk about Shakespeare, about De Certeau, Michel de Certeau, and one which I particularly love, involving dietetic morality, banquet brutality, and medical malice in Nicolas de Chesnay's Condamnation du Banquet of the 16th century. So Professor Thomas, it comes to us with deep study of food, culture, and history, notably in the 16th century, and today is going to address that topic with his paper on Cuisine by the Cut of One's Trousers, Cookbook Marketing in Early Modern France. So please welcome Professor Thomas.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Graham, for a wonderful introduction and for your hospitality here in Columbus. I had the great pleasure of sharing a couple of meals and really rich conversation. It's been a wonderful welcome. I'd like to also thank the CMRS for inviting me to this series. Whenever I see words like feast and famine, my ears prick up, so I'm very happy to be a part of the series. I should maybe begin by just sort of issuing a little bit of a warning. Having a lecture at 3 o'clock that's about food is inherently problematic. If there are some inopportune stomach rumblings, I will just take it as a compliment. So, early modern French cuisine and cookbooks have gotten a bad rap. One explanation for the lack of attention to this cuisine is that it has been plagued by misconceptions, stereotypes, and outright errors that have held on with uncommon tenacity. Spices were used to hide the taste of tainted meat. Catherine de Medici single-handedly revolutionized French Renaissance cuisine by importing her Florentine cooks and introducing the fork. No new French cookbooks appeared during the 16th century. Modern historians have gone to great lengths to dispel these and other myths regarding early modern French cuisine. However, their efforts have been impeded by the critical inertia established in the culinary historiography of the early 19th century, which continues in some forms even today. One of the most pervasive and long-held myths about early modern French cuisine is that all cookbooks printed in France in the 16th century were mere reprints of medieval texts or slavish continuations of medieval style and taste. This myth finds its roots in Jérôme Pichon's introduction to his 1846 edition of the medieval household treatise and cookbook, The Ménager de Paris. Pichon argues that the Ménager borrows recipes from an earlier manuscript source that he found to be reprinted in the 1540s under the title Le Grand Cuisinier de Toute Cuisine. Since this text had been reprinted under other titles throughout the 16th century, Pichon concludes that all Renaissance cookbooks are reprints of medieval texts. The import of this myth for culinary studies of early modern France can be glimpsed in an authoritative culinary dictionary, the 1938 Larousse Gastronomique. After a preface by famed chef Auguste Escoffier, this culinary encyclopedia presents a bibliography of both ancient and modern culinary texts. The list begins with two medieval cookbooks, the Viandier and the Ménager de Paris. The Viandier is dated 1370, with the Ménager following in 1393. Astonishingly, the next item on the list is Lavarenne's Cuisinier Français, the first edition of which was published in 1651. The obvious implication here is that after the end of the 14th century, There is nothing new under the sun in French culinary matters for 2.5 centuries. Contrary to what many culinary historians have been asserting, at least up until the last couple of decades, the French Renaissance actually did have a thriving trade in homegrown contemporary cookbooks. The majority of these texts can be divided into three groups. The first group includes the printed versions of the medieval Viandier, literally Book of Foods, which first circulated via manuscripts in the 14th and 15th centuries, and is most often associated with the royal cook Taillefer. The second group is a French translation of a Latin text on dietetics and cookery, De Honesta Voluptate et Valetudine, in English, on right pleasure and good health. This work was composed by the Italian humanist Bartolomeo Sacchi, better known as Platina. Finally, beginning in the 1530s, a third cookbook family begins to circulate from the presses of the Parisian printer Pierre Sergent. By analyzing title pages, woodcuts, and other paratextual elements in these various texts, I will suggest that cookbooks in early modern France were being marketed to a wide spectrum of social stations and potential readerships. As a result, new tastes were being formed in response to new texts, and vice versa. As we will see, early modern French cookbooks, cuisine, and banquets could be adapted to a variety of means. As the French proverb has it, selon la jambe le coupe, that is, according to the cut of one's trousers. The 15th century printed French cookbook known as the Viandier galvanized a reappraisal of early modern cuisine by updating its culinary repertoire and making its text more accessible to an increasingly wide audience. Considered the first cookbook printed in France, the Viandier became a culinary bestseller, appearing in at least 25 editions between 1486 and 1615. Though the base text of recipes was not substantially altered from edition to edition, a wealth of information regarding the target audience for the Viandier can be gleaned from the titles and front matter unique to particular editions. I will argue that the front matter contained in a number of printed editions of the Viandier demonstrates how this cookbook was marketed to a variety of readers from different social milieu and financial backgrounds. However, before delving into the print history of this cookbook, it would be appropriate to at least sketch out the main lines of the Viandier's manuscript tradition. While this culinary text clearly traces its origins to the tables of the nobility, we will see how successive adaptations open it up to tables of much lesser means. Medieval French cookbook manuscripts are relatively rare. Of the half dozen or so that appear between 1300 and the end of the 15th century, only one appears in more than three copies. The Viandier was indeed the culinary bestseller of the Middle Ages, serving in some sense, the inevitable anachronism notwithstanding, as the medieval equivalent of the joy of cooking. Like the perennially updated modern American cookbook classic, and perhaps in the end, like all cookbooks, the manuscripts of the Viandier evolve with each successive recopy. French culinary historian Bruno Loriot affirms the existence of 12 manuscripts of the Viandier. He further hypothesizes the existence of two others that would have served as sources for the late 14th century Ménager de Paris and the 15th century printed edition of the Viandier, respectively. Of these 12 manuscripts, four exist only as mentions in the records of medieval libraries. Of the remaining 8 manuscripts, 3 were destroyed, and one other exists only as a fragment compiled along with a variety of non-Viandier recipes. The remaining 4 extant manuscripts, set forth in Terence Scully's critical edition of the Viandier, you can see the bibliographical information about this text on the handout. These 4 manuscripts form the basis of our knowledge of this cookbook. The earliest manuscript of the Viandier, referred to as S, appears as a true manuscript scroll, and was produced at some point within the first 2 decades of the 14th century. Unfortunately, the first few lines of this manuscript have been cut away, and so the title, if it indeed possessed one, and the first few recipes are missing. And incidentally, you can't see it on this particular image, but there are apparently points in this scroll where you can see grease spots in the margins. So there's at least a sense that this could have been something used in an actual kitchen. In any event, the S manuscript contains the main kernel of recipes that will appear again and again in later manuscripts. Chronologically, the next manuscript of the Byongyi, known as N, appears during the second half of the 14th century and is attributed to a certain Taifeng. Though a few recipes, as well as a list of spices, have been added to the text, the majority of the recipes remain the same as in the earlier manuscript. The two other manuscripts, M and V, appear much later, around the middle of the 15th century. In both texts, Taifeng is still given as the author, but the texts of the cookbooks have undergone substantial alteration. In the case of the M manuscript, many recipes have been rewritten for greater clarity, as opposed to the laconic and somewhat telegraphic style of the earlier manuscripts. Moreover, a handful of new recipes have been added to the original kernel of Yongye recipes. Finally, the V manuscript undergoes even more substantial rewriting and includes just over 40 recipes that do not belong to any of the previous manuscripts of the Yongye. In both of these later manuscripts, the added recipes represent, to a certain degree, changes in taste that occur in the 15th century. As I've mentioned, the Byongyi is traditionally linked to the name of Taifeng, the nickname of Guillaume Tirel, who served as royal cook to Charles V and Charles VI. Taifeng enjoyed a long and illustrious career between 1326 and 1395, a more than 60-year stint as a cook to a number of noble personages, including these two kings of France. As you can see from this image, which is taken from Taifeng's tombstone, this royal cook made no bones about his status in society. Pictured standing between his two wives, wearing a full suit of armor and sporting a shield, sword, and mace, there is little doubt Taifeng wanted his noble status inscribed for posterity. However, if we look closely at the coat of arms on his shield, we can see equal pride in his chosen profession. The three cooking pots or cauldrons depicted here clearly demonstrate that Taifeng's prowess was not on the battlefield, but rather in the kitchen. Though the Byongyi may be forever linked to the name Taifeng, it has been firmly established that this Taifeng could not have written the earliest manuscript of the Byongyi. The earliest known manuscript appears within the first two decades of the 14th century. Given the latest date possible of Taifeng's conjectured birth between 1310 and 1315, it is highly unlikely that a boy of 5 or 10 years old could have produced such a text. It is far more likely that Guillaume Tirel reworked a pre-existing compendium of recipes and put the stamp of his name on it, Taifeng. Even if this moniker stuck in later versions of the cookbook, clearly other alterations were made to what can be seen as a relatively malleable text. Thus, the manuscript tradition of the Byongyi is already not at all a staple. Each manuscript adds to, subtracts from, or in some other way modifies what has come to be known as the main kernel of recipes, dating from around the turn of the 14th century. The various existing manuscripts of the Byongyi are thus not the work of one culinary mind, but rather a collective compilation over time. In both literal and metaphorical terms, we could see the Byongyi as a kind of palimpsest, a relatively stable set of recipes, a parchment, repeatedly written over by successive scribes, each adducing a particular flair, or in some cases, some new recipes. Though one might assume that the advent of print would put an end to the endless recopying and reworking of the manuscript tradition, as we will see, the printed editions of the Byongyi are no less subject to change, alteration, and recasting. The printed Byongyi appeared for the first time in around 1486. From the Parisian printer, Antoine Caillou. This first edition differs substantially from the already dynamic manuscript tradition of this text. Indeed, it has been demonstrated that only a third of the over 200 culinary preparations in the printed Byongyi come from the manuscript tradition. The other two-thirds remain largely independent from any other extant medieval cookbooks. The substantial adaptations of the printed edition reflect a larger process of change in culinary tastes and practices. Such changes suggest the emergence of a nouvelle cuisine that contrasts sharply with a number of previously accepted practices and tastes common to the manuscript Byongyi tradition. and in fact other medieval cookbooks. While making manifest the beginnings of a culinary revolution, the printed viandier also remains tacitly faithful to many core culinary mentalities of medieval French cooking. Straddling the threshold of a liminal culinary space, the printed viandier provides a Janus-like perspective on culinary literature that looks backward in homage to or nostalgia for the past, yet glances forward to the horizon of culinary transformation to come. Between 1486 and 1615, the viandier appeared in 25 editions, the text of which conformed to the format of the first edition, with a few noteworthy exceptions. Most of these editions came from printers in one of the two main printing centers in France, Paris and Lyon. That said, one did appear in Vienne, in the Dauphiné, from the presses of Peter Schenk, that's 1490, and another was published in 1515 by Jean de Guerlain in Toulouse. From a conservative estimate of the copies produced for each edition, it becomes clear that around 25,000 copies of the Viandier were put into circulation between the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the 17th century. While these editions congregated around Paris and Lyon, they were not strangers to other corners of France. As such, the printed Viandier reigns supreme among cookbooks in terms of both sheer numbers and geographic circulation. It has been argued that the material formats used for the printed editions of the Viandier suggest this cookbook was designed and marketed for a popular audience rather than an upper class or intellectual milieu. The incunable editions of the Viandier all appear as quarto volumes, while those in the early 16th century are reduced to octavos. After 1580, the size of the various volumes is further reduced to the sextodecimo format, a true pocket book. This progressive reduction in size implies a reduction in the ultimate cost of the book. The later editions might thus have been within the financial means of a much larger portion of the book-buying public. Moreover, the type used for almost all the printed editions of the Viandier is Gothic. The one exception is the last Lyon edition, published by Antoine Hugoton in 1615. Culinary historians Mary and Philip Hyman argue that the use of Gothic type implies an intended audience in the popular circles of the bourgeois and commoners, whereas the use of Roman script implies an educated or humanist milieu. However, the use of Gothic type does not necessarily preclude an audience among members of the social or intellectual elite. Literary works that were considered popular, such as the Roman de la Rose or Villon's Grand Testament, though at first printed in Gothic, were printed in Roman type as of the 1530s. Gothic texts may have been appreciated by commoners for a longer time before Roman type became universally used, but that does not necessarily mean that a humanist would balk at reading a Gothic text. As such, the striking popularity of the printed Viandier cannot be fully explained as a matter of type. Other factors also contributed to its wide-ranging circulation. The titles of the various editions firmly attach the text to Taillevent, who, as head cook to the King of France, represents an aristocratic culinary authority. Yet a number of features of the printed editions imply an audience that may not have been privy to aristocratic circles. The title of the first edition, the Editio Princeps of the Viandier, reads as follows. Hereafter follows the cookbook for dressing all sorts of foods, which was composed by Taillevent, cook of our Lord the King, for dressing and preparing boiled dishes, roasted dishes, salt and freshwater fish, as well as sauces, spices, and other things that are appropriate and necessary for this, as will be stated hereafter. The title displays a certain redundancy in that it begins by proclaiming that the cookbook will demonstrate how to prepare all sorts of foods, but it then goes on to enumerate the precise types of foods that will be prepared. It is noteworthy that Taillevent's name is given prominence, as it is qualified by his status as cook to the king. Many of the incunable editions that subsequently appear follow this same titular pattern. One exception is the edition produced in Lyon by Martin Avard between 1495 and 1496. The title page of this edition reads simply, Le Cuisinier Taillevent, and offers a woodcut of a cook holding a long-handled pan over an open fire. Given the image of a cook, it is tempting to translate the title as the cook Taifeng. But given the context, it is much more likely something like Taifeng's cookbook. On the verso of this title page comes a copy of the very same woodcut, the facing page of which inaugurates the text proper with the standard incipit we saw in the Abhidhamma precepts. This image is clearly of a practicing cook, familiar with the equipment and tricks of the trade necessary for cooking over an open flame. The emphasis is thus on production rather than consumption. After 1500, printed editions of the Viandier give Taifeng more prominence and stature. As of Guillaume Nivert's editions of the Viandier from Paris, 1500 to 1519, Taifeng is referred to as the Grand Cuisinier du Roi de France, great cook of the King of France. This status is maintained in all of the editions of the Viandier printed in Lyon after 1545, in which the complete title consistently reads, quote, "The Book of Taifeng, Great Cook to the King of France." Like the Martin Avau edition, Guillaume Nivert's edition of the Viandier is introduced by a woodcut. Under the title, we are given the image of three people involved in a market exchange. The man on the left, wearing noble clothing, gestures to a hunchbacked man on the right, who is holding a basket of ducks in one hand and two ducks in the other. Clearly, a poultry purchase is being arranged, with perhaps a maître d'hôtel on the left doing the buying and the hunchback doing the selling. As the exchange takes place, a woman, perhaps the lady of the household, looks on from a nearby window. As with the earlier woodcut from Martin Avar, the depicted scene is clearly one of culinary preparation and production rather than consumption. Following the woodcut, the text of Nivelle's edition begins with the phrase, quote, "Here follows the art and science of dressing foods." Taifeng is thus endowed with a type of culinary prestige where cooking is considered both an art and a form of specialized knowledge. Taifeng's status seems to reach its apogee in an edition published a decade or so after Nivelle's. Between 1531 and 1533, Jean Meunier publishes an edition of the Viandier with a title unlike any others. It reads, quote, "The book of the great and most excellent cook Taifeng, which is useful and profitable for all kinds of people who wish to dabble at dressing all sorts of foods, whether fresh or salted, as well as saltwater and freshwater fish, for the service of kings and princes, as well as in other eminent households." On the one hand, Taifeng appears even more exalted in this title than in any of the others. He is not only a great cook, but also a most excellent one. On the other hand, unlike earlier editions of the work, this one foresees an audience that would not be strictly limited to royal or even noble circles. It clearly democratizes its potential audience as all kinds of people. This edition of the Viandier thus breaks away from a strictly noble banquet meal to attract an audience with more modest means and culinary motivations. Meunier's edition of the text is also noteworthy because it is the only one to offer a significant alteration to the Viandier text. At one point, the normal exposition is interrupted by the phrase, quote, "added here the way of making several stews which have never appeared in Taifeng's book." What follows are 13 recipes that have no antecedents in any other editions of the Viandier. These recipes were in fact taken from the French translation of the dietetic treatise/cookbook De Onesto Voluptate e Valetudine, composed by the Italian humanist Platina, which I mentioned at the start. The original Latin text had been composed in the late 15th century, but the first French translation did not appear until 1505. Thus, in a text that is already enacting a profound reworking of its medieval antecedents, an editor of a printed edition of the Viandier goes a step further by appending contemporary recipes from an entirely different source. Moreover, Meunier's borrowing transcends the supposed separation between a popular, practical text and one with humanistic aspirations. And I'll talk a little more about this in a few minutes. Around the same time as Meunier's edition of the Viandier, as well as in later ones, The front matter of the printed viandier seems to suggest an audience keen on consumption rather than production. The title page of Alain Lautrillon's second Paris edition of the viandier, printed around 1530, offers a woodcut image that privileges the table over the kitchen. In the woodcut image, we see four figures around a rather sparsely laden table. On the table, there is a knife, perhaps a wine cup, a small loaf of bread, and a couple of smaller dishes. The two men behind the table seem to be gesturing with their hands, perhaps engaging in an animated conversation. A third in the foreground is having his feet washed in a basin by a woman, a scene clearly reminiscent of the Last Supper with Mary Magdalene washing the feet of Jesus. Like the food on the table, the clothing of these figures does not seem overly elaborate. The overall image suggests a somewhat modest social class and corresponding cuisine. In a later 1545 edition produced in Lyon by the presses of the deceased Barnabé Chaussard, the title page woodcut reinforces the consumption side of the text's orientation. The woodcut in this edition is clearly of a banquet scene, with a somewhat more heavily laden table surrounded by three men and two women. There seem to be a few more items on this table than on the previous one, including what looks like a salt cellar in the middle of the table. The two men and women seated behind the banquet table are all bedecked in rather elaborate dresses or fur-collared coats. Moreover, the two diners on the right are wearing what appear to be crowns, perhaps suggesting royalty. The standing figure on the lower left appears to be a servant, either delivering a new dish to the table or preparing one for service. While these figures seem to belong to a higher class than those in the earlier Lautrillon edition of the viandier, the import of the image is clearly at the table rather than the kitchen. Thus, the front matter contained in a number of printed editions of the viandier demonstrates that this cookbook was marketed to a variety of readers from a variety of social media. The cuisine contained within the text is presented as that of an aristocratic cook. Yet the Gothic typescript used by the various printers may or may not suggest tacit marketing to a more popular reader. The woodcut images in the earliest editions seem oriented toward the practitioner, the cook, while later ones seem geared toward actual diners at table. The images and titles thus suggest that some editions oriented themselves towards aristocratic media, while others were expressly designed for the more modest tables of the lower nobility or upper bourgeois class. In one sense, the extraordinary circulation of the printed viandier can be attributed to the dynamic evolution of marketing strategies in the burgeoning print culture of the early French Renaissance. Indeed, the printed viandier effectively covers all the bases in terms of target audience. By reaching a much larger readership, this cookbook made available an entire range of culinary vocabulary that had previously only circulated orally among professionals. Written in a much more approachable and reader-friendly style than its laconic predecessors, the printed viandier offered a sense of the French culinary imagination to both learned and lay readers alike. Now, after that rather long and substantial first course, I propose a short and perhaps sweeter intermezzo to allow you to cleanse your intellectual palates. Something light and healthy, vaguely Italian, perhaps. Give it a taste. A second Renaissance French cookbook circulated less widely, but in spite of its formal status as a dietetic treatise, still managed to carve out a sizable share of the cookbook market. Beginning in 1505, the French translation of Platina's Latin text on dietetics and cookery, De Onesta Voluntate et Valetudine, circulated in 14 French editions throughout the 16th century. The French edition profoundly transforms Platina's Latin text, inserting additional dietetic advice, sometimes in fact contradictory dietetic advice, and specific commentary about contemporary French eating habits. The full title of the French translation illustrates its insistence on medically ordained culinary practice. It begins, quote, "Platina in French, very useful and necessary for the human body, which treats virtuous pleasure and all foods and things that man eats." The emphasis here is on how food can be used appropriately for the benefit of the human body. The title page ends by indicating that Platina's text contains, quote, many other niceties through which man can maintain himself in prosperity and health without the need of a doctor, if he is a man of reason. Far from a simple cookbook filled with numerous recipes, this text bills itself as a substitute physician, provided one understands the medical theory on which it is based. Looking at the title pages from two early editions of Platina in French, we can see that the audience may not be a strictly culinary one. The image on the left is of the first edition of Platina in French, published in Lyon by François Fradin in 1505. The title page here is rather plain, with only one historiated letter P for decoration. Otherwise, the title is identical to what was cited earlier. The image on the right is from the 1519 edition, published in Paris by Michel Benoit. And here, in addition to the historiated P, we also have a woodcut representing three scholars engaged in various stages of reading and writing. The implied audience, thus, might be a more humanist, intellectual one. And indeed, the image seems to have virtually no relation to the contents of a dietetically oriented cookbook. It is also noteworthy that later editions of the French Platina are published in Roman type, that which is generally associated with humanistic texts, rather than the more popular Gothic type of these earlier editions. As a text that is already half dietetic treatise and half cookbook, the French Platina also vacillates between targeting a popular audience and a humanist one. I could say much more about the French Platina, and in fact, we'll come back to this text at least very briefly in a few moments, but perhaps we should press on with the next course. So, on to the third and less well-known group of cookbooks. Between 1536 and 1627 appear 27 editions of a cookbook associated with the printer Pierre Sergent, almost doubling the number of French Platinas and surpassing the number of Viandiers put into print. The large number of editions, coupled with the remarkable recycling of recipes among them, bears witness to the literate public's appetite for cookery books in France around mid-century and beyond. In terms of structure and format, the Sergent family of cookbooks follows consistent patterns, though the actual number of recipes increases with each successive edition. The first in the series, published between 1536 and 1538, is a modest octavo containing 40 leaves and a total of 133 recipes. It begins rather simply with the title, quote, "The little treatise in which you will see how to cook and how one must prepare all sorts of foods, very useful for each and every person, newly printed in Paris." Under the title appears a woodcut of a rather richly dressed noble figure, wearing a feathered hat, sporting a long sword cinched to his belt, and holding what appears to be a game bag. At first glance, this image does not seem at all relevant to a cookbook. As we saw with the title pages of the printed Viandier, the corresponding woodcuts displayed actual cooks in the kitchen, or at least people seated around a banquet table. By using an image of nobility to illustrate his cookbook, perhaps the editor of the Petit Traité was endeavoring to reassert the nobility of French cuisine in 16th century France. Or such an image may have been used to attract a more noble audience. Or this was simply the only woodcut that the printer had on hand. The text of the recipes, like the title, are in Gothic script and are inscribed with very little in the way of an organizing structure, except for the occasional rubric to mark the beginning of a new recipe. They do, however, follow a pattern that reflects the division of a meal into separate courses. The text begins with soups and stews and fricassees that are typically served in the first course of the banquet. Following these recipes are those for roasted meats. The substantial recipes for meats are then followed by those for the lighter fare of the final course, creams, pastries, and vegetables. Additional recipes are then appended for fast days, including fish and egg dishes, and recipes for people who are sick. Following the last fish recipe, several menus are appended. Some are for elaborate wedding feasts, and others are for more simple repasts. Intermixed among the menus are occasional blocks of additional recipes that seem to be added more or less at random. Finally, the cookbook concludes with a text designed for organizing banquets. It reads, "Memorandum, when you want to have a banquet, look in this chapter. You will find memoranda for writing your menu." What follows is a list of 185 dishes, some of which are complicated preparations whose recipes can be found within the cookbook, and some which are simply names of various foods. Around 1539, shortly after the publication of the Petit Traité, Sergent issues a new, updated version of his text. The title page reads, "The Book of Cookery, very useful and profitable, containing within the manner of preparing all foods, with the manner of serving at banquets and feasts, all of it revised and corrected beyond the first printing by the great squire of the kitchen." While the identity of the great squire of the kitchen remains unknown, the name itself may explain in part the woodcut from the title page of the Petit Traité, which, as you can see, is also reproduced under the title of the Livre de Cuisine. Since it has been revised and corrected based on an earlier printing, we can assume from the title alone that it is a revised version of the Petit Traité. The recipes confirm the affiliation of the two texts, since the Livre de Cuisine reproduces all but one of the recipes from the Petit Traité. However, the Livre de Cuisine does offer two significant revisions. First, it adds over 200 new recipes to the collection, almost tripling the total number of recipes. Second, it facilitates the reading of the cookbook by adding a table of contents that organizes all the recipes alphabetically, providing folio numbers where they appear. In all other respects, the Livre de Cuisine shares format characteristics with the Petit Traité, including the menus and the banquet memorandum mentioned earlier. In 1542, and again in 1555, the exact same text is then reprinted in Lyon. The title begins somewhat differently as "The Most Excellent Book of Cookery," and then reproduces the rest of the title from the Livre de Cuisine. If we take a closer look at the woodcut to this edition, we see a seated man writing on what appears to be a manuscript scroll. If we go back to the image of the French platina, we can see a similar figure on the far right. It could certainly be argued that this woodcut was simply the only one the Lyon printer had on hand. However, it is tempting to suggest that the choice of woodcut here demonstrates a desire on the part of the Lyon publisher to market the text to a more learned humanist audience, as may have been the case for the French platina. As we will see, later editions of this cookbook will enjoy just such a mixture of readerships. Between 1542 and 1543, the final stage of the Sergent family of cookbooks begins to appear. The title for the first representative in this stage reads, quote, "The Flower of All Cuisine, containing the manner of preparing all foods, both meat and fish, and of serving at banquets and feasts. Also the manner of writing a menu for a banquet, composed by several cooks and revised and corrected by Pierre Pidou." Rather than the work of one person, as in the Livre de Cuisine, this version of the text has been written by several cooks. Moreover, it has been revised again by a certain Pierre Pidou, whose identity remains, unfortunately, a mystery. Thus, though we have the hint of a name behind this particular text, the authorship of the Sergent family of cookbooks remains essentially anonymous. After Sergent's death in 1547, his son-in-law, Jean Bonfons, brings out yet another edition of La Fleur de Toute Cuisine under the title Le Grand Cuisinier de Toute Cuisine, a title that became standard in all the numerous subsequent editions of this cookbook. In the woodcut of this first edition of the Grand Cuisinier, we see again a practicing cook. He appears to be sliding some sort of fowl onto a large spit, undoubtedly in preparation for roasting on the open fire to the right. If we compare this woodcut to what we saw in the first two incarnations of the Sergent family of cookbooks, we can see that the figure from the Grand Cuisinier appears much more like a rough and ready cook, a man who knows how to mettre la main à la pâte, as we say in French, to get his hands ready. While the figure from the Petit Traité seems to be a generic noble figure with no obvious visual link to the realm of cuisine. Moreover, The figure on the right is much larger, or perhaps just more imposing, than the figure on the left. Putting aside the perennial question of whether or not size actually matters, it is clear that the final text in the series is indeed the longest, and in the end, the most enduring. The base text of the Fleur, and thus all editions of the Grand Cuisinier, is 302 recipes taken from the 305 recipes of the Livre de Cuisine. To this is added 109 recipes taken from the 14th century Book of Household Management, the Ménager de Paris. 16 recipes from the French Platina also appear, as well as 51 recipes from an unidentified but presumably medieval source. The result is an unprecedented grand total of 478 recipes. The Grand Cuisinier is thus true to its name, the largest cookbook in France before the 17th century. As was mentioned at the start of my talk, given the close affiliations of the Sergent family of cookbooks, the relatively small number of recipes taken from the Ménager de Paris led 19th century bibliophile Jérôme Pichon to conclude that all 16th century French cookbooks were mere reprints of medieval sources. This conclusion clearly did not take into account the bulk of the other recipes in the Grand Cuisinier that have no medieval antecedents, and thus created the unfortunate myth that the French Renaissance was a stagnant period of cuisine. Indeed, the fact that the recipes from the French Platina were incorporated into the Grand Cuisinier suggests not only that recipes did circulate in Renaissance cookbooks, but also that they did so among contemporary texts. The result of this complex compilation is a compendium of recipes that draws slightly from the medieval culinary repertoire, but that clearly privileges the innovative cuisine of mid-16th century France. If the Fleur de toute cuisine represents a true flowering of Renaissance cuisine, the Grand Cuisinier continues to trumpet the culinary grandeur of France through the end of the century and beyond. However, this grandeur was not solely limited to those of grand stature. Indeed, a preface added to a later edition of the Grand Cuisinier suggests that the audience for this cookbook may in fact be much wider. And here I will summarize and cite a few tasty morsels from the 1576 edition by Nicolas Bonfons. Addressing his readers directly, the editor stipulates that this cookbook is being published specifically, quote, to satisfy lords, rich bourgeois, and others of lesser means of quality. Thus, the later editions of the Grand Cuisinier seem to be targeting a wide spectrum of social stations in terms of potential readerships, some of them with contradictory desires. The preface writer specifically targets readers who are interested in the seemingly mutually exclusive desires of maintaining proper health and holding banquets. He reminds the reader that the doctors and intellectuals of the age have provided a host of information about maintaining one's health. Yet, their bits of advice have generally fallen on deaf ears. Does this sound familiar to anyone? The result of this attitude is a body perpetually plagued by illness and a sense of taste dulled and blunted by excess. The solution to the problem, the preface writer suggests, is some sort of aiguillon d'appétit, spur to the appetite, that he feels will be found in the present cookbook. He thus offers a true homeopathic remedy by proposing to cure the ills of the period with the very poison that engendered them. Yet, he is quick to defend himself against the potential charge of espousing gluttony. He has decided to publish this cookbook, quote, not to incite whoever it might be to gluttony, delicacy, lustiness, or uncontrolled expense, or even to mediocrity in a low station, but for the good and solace of all people, healthy or sick. Given that this preface is to a work containing almost 500 recipes, and several menus for organizing elaborate banquets, we must take his defense with, at the very least, a grain of salt. The paradoxical solution to perceived ills and blunted taste is thus to hold banquets. Yet the purpose of these banquets is actually much more widely understood. The preface writer is addressing those people who, quote, as the occasion or affair requires for the maintenance of friendship and alliances, or even moved by a happy heart and joyful affection, even during days of recreation or otherwise, are required to hold feasts and banquets for relatives, friends, and allies. The banquet thus holds a place among family and friends, but also among allies, whether religious, political, or other. Readers may wish to organize banquets just out of the kindness of their hearts, but the presumption is that they are occasionally moved to do so for more practical or even political reasons. Moreover, the banquets suggested by the cookbook can be tailored to fit all levels of economic or aesthetic criteria. Banquets can be made, quote, magnificent and sumptuous, or more modest and of lesser cost and quality, and, as our common proverb tells us, according to the cut of one's trousers, that is, according to one's ability and station. A 16th century banquet is thus not limited to an elite sector of society. The banquet is a space whose contours can be adapted to fit a number of occasions and accommodate diners from all strata of society. The Sergent family of cookbooks thus makes possible all varieties of banquets for all varieties of banqueters. Furthermore, from within a text that has been marketed to a variety of potential readers. Given the mixture of dietetic and banqueting advice in the later editions of the Grand Cuisinier, it should come as no surprise that publishers and readers confuse this text with the French Platina, and vice versa. A 1567 edition of the Grand Cuisinier was published under the title Livre d'Honnête Volupté, Book of Honest Pleasure, a title clearly associated with Platina's text. In 1584, Platina's French text appears under the title Le Grand Cuisinier de B. Platine. Cuisine and dietetics thus become inseparably intertwined, as do the markets for cookbooks and dietetic treatises. Yet the intermixing of genres and book markets does not stop there. In Renaissance natural histories, we often see recipes and banquet advice alongside zoological and anatomical discourses. Writing about the banquets of antiquity, botanist and naturalist Pierre Boulogne, in his History of the Nature of Birds, writes, after having written down the dishes of the ancients, excerpted from their books, let us put down our own, as they are commonly served in the French manner, according to what we have excerpted from a little booklet entitled The Memorandum for Writing a Menu for a Banquet. We thought it deserves to be inserted at this point for the diversity of French names found in it. Following this statement, Boulogne cites in its entirety the memorandum menu, which, as we saw, was originally published in the Petit Traité and subsequently reprinted in all the other members of the Sergent cookbook family. Here, cookbook menus enter the realm of scientific and linguistic discourses and thus become opened up to yet other markets and readerships. Boulogne goes on to say that if the reader is not satisfied with this list of foods, a similarly lengthy one can be found in Rabelais' literary work, The Quart Livre, or Fourth Book. Now the language of cookbooks and menus cannot be distinguished from literary texts, and so the market for practical works on food spills over into the market for fiction and fantasy. In closing, I hope I've been able to give you a glimpse of the remarkable circulation of culinary texts in Renaissance France. By strategically marketing cookbooks to the widest audience possible, the various printers of the Viandier, the French Platina, and the Sergent family of cookbooks were undoubtedly endeavoring to ensure a profitable market share. However, in so doing, they also made available to modest tables the means to imagine, if not produce, the meals of the cultural and culinary elite. Platina reminds us of the dietetic constraints of food and cooking in Renaissance France, but his text would have been welcome on the shelf of a budding humanist, as well as that of a practicing cook. In presenting aristocratic cuisine in modest formats, all of these cookbooks would have provided the space to dream culinary dreams. In a sense, the early modern French cookbook rises from its ignoble station in the bowels of a grimy kitchen to take its place in a more ethereal realm of the culinary imagination, where words take the place of things and dreams of satiation can be resolved and sublimated. However, as the Sergent cookbooks remind us, even if these dreams are available to any of us, They must still be adapted to fit our particular needs, to be read and appreciated by the cut of one's trousers. In the end, with new texts come new tastes. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting talk about an important topic. We have time for questions, and then afterwards, normally we bring some tables together so we can have a more wide-ranging conversation. But let's have some questions now for Professor Thompson.
I have a quick question. Toward the end of your talk, you sort of answered one of my questions, which had to do with reaching out to kind of broadening audiences of lesser means, right? But I wanted to ask you sort of two things. One was, could you give us some examples of what would be these more innovative or new dishes that were incorporated in the Renaissance, you know? And then, following that, what are the dishes like that are targeting the more humble audience? I mean, is there an equivalent of the bologna sandwich and mac and cheese?
I would think that they certainly had to exist, but they didn't necessarily show up in the cookbooks. I think what's interesting to me is that the actual text of the recipes themselves and the text itself of the cookbook don't really change depending on what that prefatory material actually suggests. So though the preface says this could be for more modest tables, the recipes are the exact same.
Okay.
So in that sense, I think some of those people, I mean, depending on who was actually reading it or who was able to read it, they might look at that and say, well, there's no way in hell I'm making that. I can't afford clothes, you know. So I mean, there's that issue. To come back to the first part of your question, I think the big differences between what we might think of as sort of traditional medieval cuisine and then what I think is happening or beginning to happen in the Renaissance, there's sort of a number of characteristics. I think the shift from using spices, which is really sort of the hallmark of medieval cuisine, you start to see less and less of the spices, often rather than individual spices, sort of in spice mixtures that are just sort of thrown in, like something like the equivalent of allspice. But you also start seeing a lot of herbs. So rather than having these exotic spices that would have cost a lot of money that came from the Orient, you had domestic herbs that were readily available. So I mean, there's one instance where you could see, you know, if someone couldn't afford these spices, they could certainly afford parsley or basil, because that's something they could get a hold of locally. So the shift from spices to herbs, you tend to see a lot more recipes that include butter in Renaissance recipes. So whereas it's typically some sort of oil or lard or bacon fat, you start to see recipes that actually have butter in them in Renaissance recipes. And often this could be the same recipe in a medieval cookbook with the same title, but suddenly that same recipe with the same title in a Renaissance cookbook has butter instead of oil.
Can I follow? Sure. That's an interesting point. Is that a Northern European phenomenon, the butter, or is that the same true for Mediterranean world, where it's olive oil
oil? Certainly the difference between butter and olive oil is this sort of classic northern southern sort of cuisine.
Right.
I think that typically the kinds of oil that you would see, I mean, in fact, maybe even using the word oil is not appropriate. I mean, it was really lard that was being used. Occasionally, depending if it were someplace in the south of France, you might see something like walnut oil, which is something that is a very important product there. But olive oil, certainly not, I'm trying to think if, there are certainly some examples of olive oil popping up in a few recipes, but I would not say that it's systematic in these kind of recipes.
You mentioned how in subsequent editions of the Vendier, they continually reference how Talleyrand was instrumental in developing these recipes, and he ascribed his name to it. I was wondering, do we have any textual evidence of how he was viewed outside of Paris to the point that cookbook authors would want to ascribe his name to their book?
Outside of Paris in France or outside of France?
Inside of France, but outside of Paris.
Right. I mean, the fact that some of these editions were actually published outside of Paris, I mean, if those are editions that are using that name, we would assume that there was a reason for it. There was some sort of cachet to that name that would have been recognized. I can think of, it's actually interesting in a literary text in Villon's Grand Testament, which is just a poetic work. He actually has a poem that is sort of a recipe, and in that poem he actually refers to Taillevent. So there you have a literary person who sort of recognizes that name and recognizes it sort of as a culinary authority. Now, whether or not that was recognized that much outside of Paris, I don't really have any evidence for that.
He was a known name.
Yeah, clearly, yes.
Would you feel that in subsequent editions read inside of France, outside of Paris, these readers began to really link and associate Taillevent in Paris?
I mean, we don't really have any sort of witnesses or sources that we could look at and say, A, were they reading the text, and B, how did they receive it? And I would have to think that since the vast majority of the type of cuisine that we see in this particular text really is very northern, and in many cases very Parisian, you know, someone in Toulouse would have to look at this and say, well, this is not the way we eat here. But we really don't have any sources that give us a good sense of how did these different people react to this text.
Through these recipes, I wonder, is there sort of a system or systems of weights and measures to follow? If so, you know, what is that? Or is it more sort of subjective, like a little bit of this, a little bit of that?
Right. It sort of depends on the period that you're looking at. If you look at the very earliest medieval manuscripts, there's almost no reference to quantities. It's sort of take your meat, take some cloves, take some vinegar. It's all very vague. So clearly there's this sort of interplay between what clearly would have been a sort of oral tradition of, you know, apprenticeship, that the cook, you learn by doing, you learn by watching. So this text is really just a recording of what would have been an oral sort of practice. So when you read these recipes, I mean, even for me, having looked at a lot of different ones, when I read the earliest recipes, sometimes you can't even follow what exactly they're saying. I mean, you can't even see what the process is because it's so telegraphed. But there are, I would say, in the later, I mean, certainly in the 15th century, in a few recipes, in the 16th century, you start to see some references to quantity. So it could be something as simple as a cup of wine as opposed to just some wine. Or particularly with spices, you start seeing, you know, essentially a quarter teaspoon or, you know, a quarter dram of this. Or, you know, so you do start to see some references to quantities, but it's typically very late.
Do you ever see examples of some of those early, just descriptive recipes, later having some quantities sort of inserted, you know, to make them a little more, I don't know, reproducible
right.
to the reader, or can you think of anything like that?
I mean, there are certainly recipes that, and we were talking about this at lunch, there are certain recipes that you see in almost every cookbook. So blancmange, which is this sort of, I think it's certainly in the French tradition and even in the British or in the English tradition of a recipe that just, you see it in every single cookbook, whether it's French or English, from the earliest, you know, texts of the Middle Ages through even into the 17th century. So it's a recipe that had sort of a long tradition, and you can sort of trace historically, see how that recipe has changed. You can see how it's prepared differently in France as opposed to in England. And in those examples, if you can find a recipe that sort of traverses those traditions, you can kind of see how that language. So it clearly becomes more reader-friendly, you have more details, sometimes particular practices, you know, a certain type of frying is actually explained in detail, whereas in a previous version, it just gives you the verb for that action and that's it. And you do slowly start to see quantities for certain things. But I would say even in the latest texts, in this kind of evolution, they're still not the kind of quantities that we would expect in a modern book. And so reproducing things, you have to use your imagination.
Do you, just thinking of the recipes in general, do you get any kind of a glimpse at social settings? Like, do recipes tend to be one goose, sort of a family size? Or are there, you know, if you're cooking for 100, or is it kind of all over the map?
I would say in most of these recipes, it's hard to get a sense of quantity in general. I mean, it could be, if it's a particular kind of meat, you can get a sense of take a chicken, you know, I mean, that gives you a sense of what it is. But since a lot of these recipes would be, I mean, if you look and compare it to the language of a menu, You know, you might see a particular title of a recipe in a menu, but if that's a menu for 50 people, obviously you're going to be preparing more than if it's a menu for 10 people. So I would not say that there's a ton of textual evidence to sort of give you a sense of what that would be.
Do we know anything about the history of the écriteau? Well, it's such an interesting word.
I mean, outside of what I've talked about, I mean, for me, it's amazing that there was this sort of confluence of different people who were looking at this particular text. So the fact that someone like, you know, Pierre Bourdon would actually be looking at, I mean, he's looking at a cookbook, which to me is already a sort of strange circumstance. Although, I mean, when we look at the natural histories, his history of birds, there's also Rondelet with his history of fish. They're just fascinating to read, where you have this long article that talks about, you know, where this particular fish lives, what's its diet, what's its habitat, how does it reproduce, and then at the end, it's really good grilled with some orange juice sprinkled on. So, it's sort of an interesting conflation of what we would think of as separate discourses. But clearly, in the Renaissance, we don't have that sort of classical division into different genres. So all this information comes together at once. But how that text circulated the way it did, for me, it's fascinating.
I'm just thinking about the association of writing with cooking.
Right.
Survey. Écriteau, what would you do with an écriteau? Do you show the tablet to the diners at the banquet?
Right.
What is an écriteau?
I mean, my sense of it is, I mean, clearly it's, I mean, all the language surrounding it is about how you prepare for a banquet. So I sort of think of it as sort of a meta text that says, here are all the possible permutations. If you're going to, you know, organize a banquet, you pick the ones that you like from this list, and then you create your own. I mean, that's sort of my own sense. And so I think the readership for this sort of a text would not, probably not be cooks. It would probably be the household managers. So these sort of maître d'hôtel, they're in charge of organizing and planning. They might say, okay, we're going to have a banquet, we're going to have these dishes, and then give that list of dishes to the cook and say, make this. So that's my sense of it. But we don't have a lot of information.
In regard to the woodcut in the Petit Traité, you were suggesting that maybe it was a squire, that was just the woodcut that they happened to have for that series. When I first saw the image, though, it looked like it was foraging, perhaps. And I'm wondering if there's any indication of the quality of ingredients or going out and doing it yourself, or if it has to be this economic transaction.
Right. I mean, certainly in terms of, I mean, if we take it that he's foraging, or, I mean, the bag really does look like a game bag. In many, I mean, in other iconography, we can see some examples of that. So, you know, the fact that he's a member of the nobility, he has the right to hunt on his lands, whereas other people would not. And certainly game, in terms of aristocratic tables, that was sort of a stalwart. I mean, that's sort of standard fare, whereas commoners, they wouldn't necessarily have access to that. So, I mean, there's certainly that side of it, but it, I guess since in that particular image, the sword is so prominent, which that sort of a sword is not something I think that one would take when one's hunting game. I mean, I'm not a professional hunter myself, let alone a Renaissance hunter, but I think sort of a strange confluence of images in that particular icon. So it's not, but foraging, I mean, that certainly would be an option, at least in aristocratic households. You know, there was an entire sort of subset of household management devoted just to, you know, providing the different sorts of foods. So people who actually went out and purchased it, but they probably also went and hunted on the lands of the lord. They had things that were already part of their own estate that they had access to, whether it's fish or eggs and things like that. So I think there's always going to be a sense of self-procurement that's part of the process, not just purchasing.
Why don't we wrap up the question and answer session? We can get together and have a more intimate conversation for those who can stay. Thanks once again, Professor Thomas, for this.
Thank you.